What about Dressler? Do you know whatever happened to him?
The last I saw of Dressler, he was headed for Russia. I understand. His engine was rough, and we were on the other side of Berlin. He went over to Russia, and I believe he came back. John Weidman said he did come back, but it must have been after I had left that he landed safely in Russia and was repatriated and rejoined the squadron. I do remember coming out on the deck one day and as I would come over Germany and really hedge hopping, as I was doing, I remember going over this field, and there right in front of me was a guy with a pitchfork. When I say right in front of me, I mean many, many yards ahead. This little dot with a pitchfork, and he went flat on his face, and to escape.
Yes.
I wasn't going to fire at him, but I remember that image of him falling flat on his face as quickly as he. That was live. That was a real person. When you bomb from 30,000 feet, or when you're fighting another airplane, it isn't a live person in the same way as that was. Or when you see a pilot coming out of his plane, then he's alive, but it's a little different. You're fighting the plane.
You don't think of it in human terms.
Not unless you know the...
How were your interactions with the local British population in general, and did you form many friendships with British people in particular?
Yeah. They were very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of people at the airfield, having gotten friendly with and really nurtured friendships.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't matter whether they were enlisted people or officers. The relations with the town were very good. It's only a town of a couple of hundred people.
Oh, okay.
You know, it had a cobbler.
A cobbler?
And it had a...
blacksmith?
It had everything. It was like a town that should have been 100 years ago. That was 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't changed. The airfield was changing it dramatically in terms of its contact with the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
These were old English yeomen, so to speak, who were living... the lifestyle of the non-landed people. The people who lived in the town were the merchants and went out into the fields and farmed and did the dairy, tended the dairy herds. And the quite well-to-do, we never had any contact with wherever they were. But my own friendships were made in the town of Letchworth. And the reason for that was there was a ground officer was called a paddlefoot. This was a nice fellow who asked me, and I don't know why he asked me, but he asked me if I would come with him and double date with him one day. He had this girl who was a refugee. Now, he wasn't Jewish. And I don't know how he knew that I was Jewish, and I don't know if he did, but I put two and two together when he said that. A refugee from Germany who his girlfriend wanted to go out with when she went out with him.
Yes.
The name was Van Emden, and they lived in Letchworth, and that started my friendship, little friendship, I suppose, with the Van Emdens, and I took out Ilse, the refugee girl, and he went out with, I forget her name, the daughter of the household, and they invited us to dinner occasionally, and we went out, about once every other week or so, every week.
Was Ilse there by herself or with her family?
No, she was a refugee. She was by herself, staying with this Jewish family.
Oh, a Jewish family?
Oh, yes,
oh,
that's
really?
What I meant. Okay. Yeah, yeah. It was a Jewish family, and he was an engineer, and they clearly were pleased that this fellow had been able to find a Jewish guy, and a pilot at that, to go out with their Ilse. It turned out, it seemed to me, that they started to want me to go out with their daughter at poor Ilse's expense. Although the daughter was lovely.
Really?
Really.
So let me get this straight. There was a Jewish family living in Letchworth.
Right.
And Ilse was staying with them.
Right.
Oh, okay. And Ilse came by herself.
From Germany. I don't know how it connected.
But she was not with her parents.
No. That was the first time, supposedly, they were taken away. But I never knew it was concentration.
Quote, unquote,
even
taken
then,
away.
Yeah, she didn't know. They were taken away.
She managed to get out by herself.
Yeah, and she may have said prison, but I don't recall her using words like Auschwitz or this or that.
Yeah.
Never. Never.
Hmm. Do you know whatever happened to her or them?
No.
All right.
When I returned home,
was this the only Jewish family in Letchworth, do you think?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't think so.
How many people lived there, rough estimate? Do you have any idea?
Letchworth?
Yeah.
A few thousand. No, Steeple Morton was 100 or 200. That was a little, tiny village.
Mm-hmm.
The village of Steeple Morton.
Yeah.
Letchworth was one of the original planned towns with the greenery was all in the center.
Oh, okay.
And then there was a ring of living quarters, houses and so forth, and then another ring around it of green sward.
Mm-hmm.
This was one of the first planned cities of its kind, environmentally planned, scenically planned, aesthetically planned in England.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the 20s or the 30s is when it was.
According to this Air Force document, you're credited officially with knocking down two German aircraft.
Yeah.
Could you describe the circumstances of those in as much detail as you feel able?
I think it was February 10th, 1945.
February 9th.
Of Magdeburg. Magdeburg, which is near Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I was flying. It was a deep penetration mission. I think we were going to going beyond Berlin, south. It must have been either Leipzig or anyway. There was a lot of cloud. There were a lot of clouds, different layers of clouds, and we were at about 25,000 feet or so, flying between two rather large layers of clouds. But there were many layers, and it was a precarious way to be flying, because you couldn't see beyond this cloud or around that one, and even though they were fairly far apart, you had to be pretty much on the alert. At my left, by dumb luck, because I should be looking to the right, but I always swiveled. I looked everywhere, and then I double-checked where somebody should be looking for me. Well, my guy, Maroney, didn't look to my left for a moment, I guess, and it only takes a moment. And out of the corner of my eye, as I was, I went look and then back, and then I realized I saw, I looked again, and there were two streams of bullets coming like this, but they were coming exactly toward me, to my left.
Converging.
Yes, but do you know what I mean when I say they were coming like this to me? Do you know what that means?
I'm not sure
when
the perspective
involved. Okay, I have to show you.
Yeah.
If you're flying like this,
yeah,
and somebody's firing at you, he has to lead you. They were coming directly toward me.
They would fall behind.
Yes. Not very far behind, but as I was moving toward this way, he was turning, and therefore they would pull up into me.
Yeah.
But at the moment, for that fraction that of time, I just knew, okay. But, so I shouted, break left, okay? 7 o'clock, low, because he was coming.
Yeah.
And I pulled back as hard as I could in hopes that I could, in a way, confront, because unless you're confronting you, you have to fire at the other guy, otherwise you can't win. You mm-hmm. must do that. And that's instinctive. I pulled back as hard as I could. And at the same time, I flipped on the gun sight. I flipped on the gun sight, pulled back. I flipped my wing tank, you know, into an internal rear tank. I pulled back fast. My tanks were stuck. It wouldn't come. So I fired a burst. Meanwhile, I'm spinning out. I stalled. But that may have been the best thing that happened to me. Because his bullets went past me now. Okay? One plane that I saw, although there were big dogfights around, there was only one that was standing. So I was in a spin, I fired, got rid of one, then the other. They didn't go off at the same time, and I'm, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Maroney called out, I got him. Great. He didn't have him. The next thing I hear as I'm spinning down, he's out turning me. This is Ed Maroney.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I'm looking up and back because it's easy to pull out of a spin in a P-51 when you're diving very fast.
Yeah.
I was going right down. I was figuring, Maroney, I got him. Okay, he'll be taking care of him. I want to get speed so I can come up and around and join the action. So I was getting good speed and looking. And as I coming up like this, okay? I could see they were circling, okay? And the ME-109 was in back of him, like this. And Maroney's up here, the ME-109 is here. I'm coming up underneath him, and I got a good burst. And my bullets were leading him, and he either saw me or got nicked. In any event, he immediately broke off and started to head down to the ground, to the deck.
Yeah.
But not like this, but at a flattish angle, okay, at about a 20-degree angle. I had excellent speed, and I came up behind him, and fired another burst. This time I nicked him, definitely. I was trying to fire very short burst because I was still far away. Got closer and closer, and then fired longer and longer burst, he then went right down to the deck, dove, and I knew I shouldn't fire while he's diving like this because he's getting too fast. So I dove with him. He leveled out on the deck, and I had everything forward, you know, older. That great plane. And I was starting to inch up on him, and I fired a very long burst. He was maybe a couple of hundred feet up. Mm-hmm. And his canopy came up with a couple of puffs on the wings, mm-hmm. you know, where it was being hit. And then he was going down closer and closer to the deck, and very long burst in there. And this plane turned over, and I flew right over it, and there was a big cannonball, mm-hmm. you know. And that was it. Oh, and the next...
109?
I mean, 109. Next thing I heard was Maroney saying, "Nice shooting, Tiger." And but now, I've told you something that couldn't have taken more than a minute or so. Couldn't have been more than a minute, maybe less. But took 10 minutes to tell.
Were you ever close enough to see any kind of markings on the plane or anything like that?
Oh, I...
Besides the German crosses, did you see anything stand out in your mind about the plane's appearance? Colors? I'm just curious if anything stuck.
Just that it was grayish black.
Yeah, okay.
And, I was firing at the plane, not at a person. Yeah, sort of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't think, hey, that's not a person. I mean, there was a pilot in it, and I was aiming right at that cockpit if I could. But it was not a living person that I knew in that sense, or that I could see the whites of his eyes.
Could you describe the other one that you were involved in? It was in November?
Yes.
Okay.
That was a very mixed-up day. That was over Hanover. I was flying with Fred Haviland. Mm-hmm. Fred Haviland later became... it was a mixed-up melee. There must have been 200 or 300 Germans coming at us mm-hmm. in a huge gaggle. And we were heading... Mm-hmm. I would say we were heading east, and they were coming west. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be a head-on collision. They had the advantage of altitude, mm-hmm. and so we tried to climb. And then suddenly, the sky was filled with airplanes, every which way. You would have think everybody would have... Well, there was a mid-air accident that day. Arnie Barab and Bill Kelly flew into each other. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever seen, well, you've never seen planes that, fighter planes that fly into each other. They went right into each other like that, apparently. And I saw it an instant later. And it was as if they both had turned to confetti. And it was all coming down like confetti. Red and silver confetti, red and silver confetti, just confetti. I mean, there were pieces too, but I remember confetti. The central mass was confetti. Fred said, I got him. Stay with me, Tide. I got him. I couldn't see what he had. I didn't see. Where they got him? Where? And then somebody yelled, "Tiger, there's someone on your tail. Look right." And I looked, and I had to keep with Fred. And I looked. I couldn't. I didn't see anybody. But I kept on going like this, you know, trying to stick with Fred, because he was my... and I couldn't see anything. And then, as I was pulling up behind Fred. He was going this way after he said he shot somebody down. And something must have been... I mean, there were things... You could see a fireball here, smoke here, and smoke trailing from planes. And I didn't know if it was our plane, his plane, their plane. You know, and suddenly, as I was pulling up to cut off Fred, I was going to cut him off by going on this side.
Mm-hmm.
So we were right. An ME-109 came in front of me. Flew right through my side. And fortunately, I saw him coming. And I just pressed the trigger. I couldn't even lead him. I just pressed the trigger. And he flew right through me. Right through my my guns. Not more than 100 yards away. Just flew right through. And you could see as he passed through all the lightning dots.
You could actually see that hit in the plane.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, in the same way as the other one. Yeah, the lightning dots.
Mm.
And just dancing all over the fuselage, the wings, the top. And it was credited as a kill. And I never knew what happened to it, but you couldn't survive 200 bullets right on the top of your head and
yeah,
engine
yeah.
and fuselage. Because I had to stay with Fred, but I had it on my gun camera.
Did you ever see your gun camera films? Were they?
Oh, yes. These are beautiful shots. By shots, I mean, they are some of the main one that's so clear is the one I just described, not flying through, but the one you could see the closure and the turns and everything and coming up very close, and you see this tail at so almost like it goes right. I was only maybe 30 feet from this guy firing.
The
at
first,
the end.
The one you previously told me about.
First one, yes.
30 feet.
Yes, I almost flew into him. I had to pull back because he was being damaged very badly by these bursts first and then the long burst. And you could see the hillsides were going up and down. It's some of the most striking aerial photography ever. I remember when it went through the bomber formation, it came from behind us and went out ahead of us. And so swiftly, I was surprised. And then it started to turn around and went out to the side and then turned around in front of us. And I got my gun sights on him and I threw off my tanks. And I remember... Hobler, Flight Officer Hobler was on my wing that day. And I pulled back, and this guy, and I was pulling back very hard in my turn, and yet he was outdistancing me on the far end of the radius. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, in other words, I was like this, and it's usually very easy to pull ahead in terms of setting your sights so he'll fly through the bullets.
Huh.
And I kept on pulling ahead, but he kept on outflying it. And finally, I was literally behind him, but he was 2 miles down or 3 miles away, and I was still firing, and there was nothing.
So
he was just outrunning our bullets, in effect.
But it was an ME-262.
Not outrunning the bullets, but they were spent before they could reach his... that was an ME-262. I remember Hogan saying, gee, I thought you had him. No.
Do you have any outstanding memories of fellow pilots who were lost?
Yeah.
Do you remember their names or anything like that? Any of them?
Well, the one that comes to mind that I
was a shock, in a way, was this fellow, Kelly, who was in the next bed to mine, in the bunk, in the sleeping quarters, and he had only been there 3 or 4 days, and he was the one that was in the mid-air collision at Hanover with another fellow from further down in the bunk named Barney Barra. And it was just a shock because he came and he was gone.
So
a nice fellow.
Yeah.
You know, a happy-go-lucky fellow.
It was just so ephemeral, his presence.
Yes, that's what struck me about
yeah.
it.